Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we hear from the director of one of the state's water agencies about how budget cuts will hurt their long-term goals. And Valley Puppeteer is using puppets to help neurodivergent kids express their feelings. But first, a judge settled a dispute last night between Arizona's Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs and our Democratic Attorney General, Chris Mays, over $115 million of opioid settlement money used to fill a hole in the state budget. Now, Maricopa Superior Court Judge John Hanna ruled that money can be used in state prisons where the governor and the legislature budgeted it. In doing so, he dissolved a temporary restraining order that Mays got just a few days ago that stopped the governor and the legislature from taking the money. In his ruling, Judge Hanna acknowledged the AG's concerns about how the state received the money and how it should be spent. But he said it isn't clear that the governor's plan to put the funds toward the Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry violates any of it. And Attorney General Mays is on the line now to tell us more about her reaction. Good morning, Attorney General.
Hi, Lauren. How are you?
Good. Thank you for coming on. So obviously, this isn't the outcome you were hoping for here. Tell us about your reaction. Will you appeal this?
Hi. Yeah, well, obviously, we're really disappointed. Despite our best efforts, the judge in the case dissolved the temporary restraining order that had prevented the opioid funds from being swept into the state budget and sent to the Department of Correction. This is $125 million in funding that should have gone to the countless Arizonans who are on the front lines of this crisis, particularly in rural Arizona. And their needs have been just completely ignored by the governor and the Republican legislative leaders in this action. But I will say the judge did not rule on the more substantive questions about whether the actions of the legislature and the governor violate the settlement agreement, or if this money will be spent in accordance with the approved purposes. Those questions still are out there, and I have serious concerns that the money won't be used appropriately. So we will see.
So tell us about your broader concerns there. Like, it seems like the judge agreed with the governor and the legislature that these funds will go toward, you know, opioid related issues in the prisons, care treatment programs, things like that.
Take that inference, but I don't think that that has been proven. And one of the things we were hoping to get was to a hearing where we could present evidence, essentially, that that's not the case. I mean, we know, for instance, that the legislature and the governor's staff were telling legislators that the money was going to be used to backfill the Department of Corrections budget, not to provide new opioid treatment. And that's what this money is supposed to be used for, is new money, new opioid treatment. They called it a budget backfill in documents that were presented to legislators. They had JLBC staff saying that it would just supplant the Department of Corrections budget. And so there's a lot of evidence that they weren't going to be using it for approved purposes. And unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to really present that evidence. So, you know, the lawyers for the governor and the legislature said in front of a judge that they plan to spend all of this money on opioid approved purposes. And we will be watching like a hawk to make sure that that actually happens, that they follow through on that. They said it in front of a judge, court of law, and they'd better follow through on it.
So let me ask you about another topic on your radar this week, the death penalty. The Arizona Supreme Court announced this week that it will weigh in on a dispute between you and Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell over basically who has the power to request a warrant of execution in the state. This comes after Mitchell did that, requested a death warrant for a prisoner on death row, which is traditionally the area under the AG. What's your argument here?
Well, you know, we're confident that the law is clear, that it is the attorney general who requests death warrants. You simply can't have 15 county attorneys going rogue requesting execution warrants. There's no legal basis for that. We've researched this, and for the last 40 to 50 years, all execution warrants have been requested by the attorney general. It has never been done by a county attorney. And, you know, on the attorney general under law speaks for the state before the Arizona Supreme Court. And so we will make that case. We've made that case already before the Supreme Court. We're pretty confident that we'll win this one. Unfortunately, Rachel Mitchell is wasting taxpayer dollars with this. I would say it's pretty clear she's doing it because she's in a tough primary race. She's got a very conservative, far right opponent, and this is sort of obviously geared toward that.
Last minute here for you. I want to ask about the broader picture when it comes to capital punishment, because you had suspended this kind of alongside the governor when you took office. But you told Mitchell's office recently you plan to take up executions again next year. Do you no longer have, the concerns going forward about how the death penalty has been playing out here?
You know, I absolutely did tell the county attorney that we intend to move forward in January or early in the year. Look, the Department of Corrections, the head of the Department of Corrections, Ryan Thornell, has indicated he is operationally ready to move forward. We have done some of our own due diligence on this. Obviously, I would like to see the judge who is doing the independent review finish his report. He was, I believe, supposed to finish that after a year. Now we're going into the second year. I think it's time to go. We have victims' families who are waiting for the sentences that were levied against the killers of their loved ones to be implemented. And in fairness to them, and in honoring the fact that we do have the death penalty in Arizona, it's time to move forward.
All right. We will leave it there for now. Attorney General Chris Mays joining us. Thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Lauren.
Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a bill aimed at stripping power at the University of Arizona away from faculty and giving it to the president and the Board of Regents. The bill was passed by the Republican-led legislature and would have spelled out the authority to approve academic degrees or create new departments, saying that it rests with the regents, who can then only delegate it to a university president. And while it would have applied to all three state universities, the bill's sponsor, Republican Travis Grantham, made it clear he was motivated by the University of Arizona's ongoing financial crisis. A $177 million budget shortfall university leadership announced last fall. They now say that shortfall has been reduced to $52 million. Grantham blamed that crisis, at least partially, on the fact that U of A President Robert Robbins didn't have complete control, unlike someone like ASU President Michael Crow. Here to tell us more about it all is Ellie Wolf, who's covered the U of A's financial troubles since the beginning. Good morning there, Ellie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So give us first some more details about what this bill would have done, how it would have stripped power from the faculty at the U of A.
It's really interesting because this bill merely changes language. So it states that the Arizona Board of Regents and university presidents would consult rather than share responsibility with faculty regarding educational and personnel matters. It's interesting, right? You were talking about how this bill came because of the UA financial crisis, but the Faculty Senate at the University of Arizona actually does not do anything with budgets. That's all President Robbins. The Faculty Senate mainly kind of oversees, you know, course offerings and majors and minors and creating new programs.
Right. So what kind of power do they have at the U of A, this Faculty Senate? Like, as Travis Grantham described it as a shared governance model, what does that mean?
Right. So, that's a good question. The University of Arizona Faculty Senate can do a lot of things where they don't actually kind of make policy, but instead vote on referendums. So, for example, this spring, they voted overwhelmingly in favor of three referendums demanding delays in layoffs, reinvestment in athletics, and downsizing of senior administration jobs. Now, they did do this, right? But mm-hmm. what does that actually mean? It's more of a symbolic vote. But like I said before, really their main power comes in the form of approving programming and doing things that have to do with the academics of the university, which isn't the thing that was really losing money and creating the deficit.
Right. So back up and remind us what was creating the deficit here.
That's a good question. So President Robbins has blamed kind of overinvestment in his moonshot projects, which include building buildings, putting a ton of money into research. You know, athletics was a huge cause. The university ended up loaning the athletics department just over $87 million over the last couple years that the department hasn't been able to pay, right? They're in their own deficit of $30 million. And, you know, making decisions like increasing financial aid for out-of-state students, which is now going to stop and be cut down. So really those core academic programs aren't causing the deficit. In fact, they're bringing in money by attracting students.
So where does the financial crisis at the U of A stand now, Ellie? Like they say they've shrunken it down to $52 million. How?
So they are projecting that by next year, the deficit will be down to $52 million from $163 million currently. Mm-hmm. That's due to a lot of factors. There have been layoffs, both at the senior administrative levels and everyday employees, right? There has also been drastic cuts to budgets, especially in senior administration. Robin said last week during the Arizona Board of Regents meeting that they were cutting administrative units by between 10 and 15%. And they were adding, and they were only cutting academics by between 3.5 and 4%. So a lot of strategic cuts and shaves, but unfortunately with the state budget, the University of Arizona is getting kind of cut in multiple ways. So they're going to have to work harder to keep finding that money.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that because there are pretty significant state budget cuts to all of the universities, including the U of A, in the state budget this year, as there were cuts kind of across the board. How might those cuts to higher ed affect all of this going forward? Where else can they turn for more cuts there?
Yeah, so the cuts to higher ed in this year's state budget are twofold because the state is cutting funding for ASU, NAU, and the UA, but they're also cutting funding for various ABOR programs, including the Arizona Teachers Academy, which is meant to increase teachers in the state and help with the teacher shortage, and also the Arizona Promise Program, which is a guaranteed scholarship program for low-income Pell-eligible students who hit a certain GPA who are in the state of Arizona in high school. So, but the problem is that the Arizona Promise Program is an unfunded mandate, meaning the government can cut, you know, $15, $20 million from it, but that means that the universities themselves are going to have to find that money and still give out those scholarships because it is a mandate. So these universities are being hit twice, right? Individual funding and cutting of the Arizona Promise program. And that's really going to affect everything, right? Like the cuts to the teacher program, it means that the wait lists are going to get longer and it's going to be even harder to address the state's teacher shortage. And the Promise program, it means that, you know, the UA is going to have to find that money from someplace else, which means more cuts in other programs, more cuts to financial aid for mm-hmm. out-of-state students. It'll probably be more difficult on athletics as well.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Ellie Wolf with the Arizona Daily Star joining us from Tucson. Ellie, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how paper puppets can be used to have important conversations about neurodivergent kids' feelings.
Even if it's just planting a seed, even if they don't know, planting the seed of, I wonder how your puppet feels right now. Or, oh, I see that your puppet's eyes are turned inward. Is your puppet angry?
We'll hear from the local puppeteer who plays Julia on Sesame Street more about it. But first, it's been a little more than a week since the Justice Department released the results of its damaging investigation into the Phoenix Police Department. It found systemic discrimination by officers, excessive use of force, and violations of the community's civil rights, especially for people of color, those experiencing homelessness, and those with serious mental illness. Officers' unions have blasted the report and say it will hurt officer morale and recruitment. Many city leaders have said for months they will not agree to federal oversight. And Phoenix City Council member and former Phoenix police officer Kevin Robinson told the show last week he expects the issue of who controls the department to end up in court. But the editorial board of the Arizona Republic came out with an editorial over the weekend declaring that a consent decree and federal oversight is the only path to reform. I'm joined now by editorial page editor Elvia Diaz and columnist Greg Moore to talk more about why. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
All right. So, Elvia, I want to start with you here. You know the arguments against entering into a consent decree, that it's costly, that it has had mixed results in other cities. Why do you think that's the only option at this point for the Phoenix PD?
Well, Lauren, you outlined it very nicely there in the introduction. You know, confronted by their own abuses of authority, the Phoenix Police Department and city leaders who oversee the police department had been completely unmoved. For years, the Department of Justice has been investigating the city, actually for 3 years exactly. They have done very little substantively to reform itself. And yes, you know, as a board, obviously, we had lengthy discussions before we wrote this editorial. And, you know, a consent decree, it is true that it's invasive, and we acknowledge that in the editorial. And it is expensive, but, you know, it is the only mechanism, the only path to accountability, again, because city leaders and police have not been able to do it themselves.
Greg, you've written about this from the perspective of the Black community, which has been disproportionately impacted by these civil rights violations, according to the DOJ report. What are you hearing? What's your reaction to kind of the fallout?
So there are a lot of folks who I talk to who say, yeah, the Justice Department just called water wet. You know, it's a no duh kind of reaction from a whole lot of people who are really plugged in and really pay attention. I think it's incumbent on Black leadership, and however that looks, whether that's elected officials, whether that's community organizers, pastors at local churches, you know, I don't care who it is, but they needed to do more sooner, because these statistics, if they weren't so troubling, would be hilarious. Like, there's no way in the world that these disproportionate numbers could be accurate unless things were so far out of balance that it just looks like nobody was paying attention. It's really frustrating.
You also wrote about how this report and its findings calls out Black leaders as much as police, you said. Why?
Yeah, well, for sure. So imagine you're a pastor at a church, and everybody at church is just kind of grumbling and complaining because they get pulled over so often picking their kids up from school. How hard would it have been to organize some kind of rally to where you go to the police station, you talk to the police officials, you invite the police into your communities, you reach out and say, hey guys, I know that you're just trying to do your job. I know what a difficult job it is, and we appreciate you. But this seems pretty out of line. This seems pretty imbalanced. You know, I think about the part of the report that mentions how many times folks were getting pulled over in school zones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just makes me wonder, right? Like, how many of those tickets were for something like texting while driving, which is a problem, but I think white people do it too. And so I think that if you were to have policing that didn't just focus on certain communities and just criminalize their very existence, that the numbers wouldn't have been so lopsided. Mm.
Elvie, I want to turn to you because the editorial really addresses the question of leadership and accountability. As you mentioned, the city and the department have said that they are making changes, have made changes. The report gives some credit to Chief Michael Sullivan for updating use of force policies and training, things like that. They launched a new crime reduction plan. But you're saying that it's clear that you cannot trust the Department of Police itself here. And it has probably something to do with this idea of leadership and accountability. What are the things that concern you most on that front?
Well, a lot of things. And let's begin with the response that they had to the investigation. For months, the city of Phoenix had been fighting the Justice Department, asking that they see the report ahead of time, you know, ahead of the public. And apparently that didn't happen. So they found out at the same time that we did. And so after a week of reading the report, of finding, and their response has been incredibly troubling. And I think it shows a kind of leadership, a lack of leadership that they have had in managing the police department. I mean, we have a very politically divided city council that had been essentially saying, we're going to fight this in court. You know, the police brass, meaning the police unions, who are very powerful in the city of Phoenix, went overdrive against the consent decree and against the federal investigation, and they have voted to fight tooth and nail. And then ultimately, the state legislature has also undermined the city's ability to oversight. So this is incredibly frustrating. I mean, the mayor, Kate Gallego, the only thing that she has been able to say is that she's going to organize listening sessions. No, that's not enough.
Greg, let me end with you here and ask you about the question of trust, right? Like, in order for a law enforcement agency to function the way it's supposed to, it has to have the trust of the community. And it sounds like that hasn't existed for a while in the Black community. Will a consent decree rebuild that? Like, what else needs to happen? Is that enough?
That's a great question. A consent decree can help. You know, what it's going to take is both sides to move toward each other. I think reasonable people can all recognize that police work is hard work. Police don't get called when things are going well. You call the police when you have no other options. And everyone recognizes, everyone with any sense, everyone who's at all reasonable, recognizes that that's a tough job. Everyone recognizes that by and large, police are good people. They would have to be in order to go into the profession because you're out there to help, to protect. But somewhere along the line, things get kind of bent and kind of twisted. And so what police then need to do is say, you know what? We can't just defend everything as if there are no problems whatsoever. We can't say stuff like 99.9% of the time we're doing okay. That's not going to cut it. So police have to acknowledge that even though they were trying to do the right thing, the people they were protecting and serving have a vastly different experience than what police intended to create. That creates an opportunity for trust because when you take accountability, when one side says, hey, we know you're giving it your best, but we're still suffering. When the other side says, hey, thanks for acknowledging that we were doing our best. We apologize for the mistakes we were making. How can we help? That's what it's got to come down to. The consent decree can point the way, but it's going to take rank and file police, police who've been doing it a long time, the newcomers. It's going to take community members, people who are new to town, people who've been here, been established. Everybody has to move toward each other because we have seen what happens in other communities when there is no trust between police and the communities they serve, and when the population swells and the problems come, things get really sideways really quickly, and you end up with entire groups of people who have no access to the system. They can't contribute to the economy. They can't get good educations. It spirals out of control so fast. These communities get cut off. They become insular. They become bigger problems. So I would hope, and I don't know how to create it, but I would hope that everybody involved moves toward each other in a respectful way, because then we can really start to see some change. And we look back 5, 10, 20 years from now and go, wow, this was a real inflection point. And Phoenix looks now as it should, because we did this the right way when we had the opportunity.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. That is columnist Greg Moore, editorial page editor Elvia Diaz, joining us this morning. Thank you both, as always. I appreciate it very much.
For sure.
It was a pleasure
having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. As the governor and state lawmakers finalized their state budget earlier this month, they had to make big cuts, enough to cover a $1.8 million budget deficit over the next 2 years. And perhaps the biggest cuts came to water. Lawmakers swept a $333 million allocation to the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority, or WIFA, one-third of a billion-dollar promise made by the legislature under former Governor Doug Ducey just a few years ago. And while lawmakers noted that the budget left $450 million in WIFA's long-term augmentation fund, the cuts are dramatic. Now WIFA's board has met to consider suing. State law says sweeps to its budget have to be approved by three-fourths of lawmakers, which didn't happen here. I sat down with WIFA Director Chuck Podolak to talk more about what they decided.
Well, I hate to ruin it, but I'm not allowed to talk about what the board talks about in open session. But I will say, I think there may be a lot of imagination, or a lot of people using their imaginations on what they think happened. I would say WIFA is a public body. WIFA board has to meet in these open meetings. And the only way that they can ask questions of their lawyers is something in executive session. Mm. And so while others may be able to just turn to their lawyer and say, hey, what should I do? What are my options? WIFA has to do it through this executive session. And so I wouldn't read too much into that. I would read, here's a group of people who are asking their lawyer, what does the law say? Mm. What are options?
Okay. So more to come on that. But it does have to do with what the law says and how state law says you can or cannot sweep funds from an agency like yours.
Yeah. And I think – I mean the law is very clear. 2 years ago, the legislature set a higher threshold for themselves. They were very, very clear. It says we cannot sweep the money unless it reaches this vote threshold. I think it's very clear fact they didn't reach that threshold. So then the question comes of – what can be done and what should be done. And those are the things that the my bosses at the WIFA board were talking about.
Okay. Let's talk about how the budget and what finally came out of it could affect what your agency is doing. What are your major concerns?
Our major concerns are the trend. We can't do this alone. We have to do this in partnership with cities and water utilities here who want to partner with us for water we bring into the state. Mm-hmm. And we have to work with the private sector. The cost of building an importation project really requires that there's contributions from outside. There's private money comes in. There's private companies that would come in and build these. And they all want to know, are we in this for the long haul? Hmm. Was this a one-off and then the state is stepping back for it? Or can we count on you as a long-term partner? We want to make sure they're a good partner, and we're going through this solid solicitation process to look for good long-term partners. But they're looking at us too, and they want to know, okay, WIFA, are you serious? And then is the state serious? Does the state have your back as you guys are entering into these long-term agreements?
So it's almost more about the reliability of the funding than it is about how much.
Absolutely. I think there was a lot of comments about, well, you don't need the money today. And in many ways, that's true. We are taking a deliberate process to make sure that before we invest anything, we know exactly that it's viable, that it's feasible, that it's needed. It's less about how much money you need in the bank today, and it's more about the reliability that the state will have our back when it comes time. And I think that's really what we're talking about. It's not the balance. It's what does this say? And people are looking at us and they're asking, did the money get taken away because you're backing away from this project or this concept? Or did the money get taken away because we don't need it right now, but we're going to be there in the future? Mm-hmm. And we're trying to figure out and others are trying to figure out, is it one or two? Which world are we in?
And you don't even have the answer to that at this point.
We have private conversations with elected leaders from the state that make us think that it's just not right now. We have your back.
Right.
But no one wants to hear that from me. They want to hear that from the leaders themselves. They want to hear that from the governor's office. They want to hear that from our legislative leadership.
Yeah. And you had been sounding the alarm for quite a while heading up to the budget negotiations. Do you feel like that fell on deaf ears?
A little bit. Yeah. We'd worked certainly with the governor's office after they put out their budget proposal. And we've been working with legislative leaders and others throughout the budget negotiations, trying to make the case that if you end up not giving us all our money, or worst case, if you take away money you've already given us, mm-hmm. then that really should be paired. That we're advocating what we want, what outsiders want to see is that paired with a statement of we're in it, just not right now. Mm-hmm. And so far, we haven't seen that.
Mm. Okay, so let's back up and spend a minute or two talking about what it is that WIFA does. You've referenced projects, partnerships, things like that. You're basically charged with looking for new sources of water for the state. So these are kind of long-term solutions, right, to a water problem we know we have, but we maybe don't have in an urgent way, at least in urban areas in the state quite yet. This all got a lot of attention a few years ago when former Governor Doug Ducey put $1 billion or said he would put $1 billion toward WIFA to fund a desalination project. But I understand it. Your efforts are broader than desalination. Yep. What's on the table?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of everything. So what I would say, WIFA, we're a state agency that uses public money to help Arizona communities secure their water future. And we do that through low-cost loans to small utilities and large utilities to upgrade their infrastructure. We do that in giving grants to communities to do water-saving projects, water conservation projects. And we do what you referenced of looking for new supplies, looking for an augmentation project or projects to eventually bring new water into the state of Arizona. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit of everything.
So there's small things and big things. What are some of the big things?
Well, probably the biggest thing is how do we find a new source of water for the state? Mm-hmm. And you referenced a desalination project. And I think when WIFA got started about a year and a half ago, a lot of the focus was on one project, one proposal. And what we've tried to do over the last year and a half is to say we're not about one project. We're about a responsible process to make sure we do it right. Mm-hmm. It's not just do a desal plant at this one location or nothing.
Yeah.
But it's about what are all the opportunities? Are there water recycling opportunities outside of the state? Are there desalination opportunities in somewhere other than Port of Penasco? Are there other water supplies throughout the western U.S. that could play a role in that? And that's the process we're going through now. It's like, okay, everything's on the table. Let's figure out the best way to do it.
Are there good options on those fronts in your mind? Like, is the state's water future looking promising from your point of view?
Yeah, I frequently get asked that question. I'm optimistic. Mm-hmm. It's hard and it's expensive. There's a reason why there's not an importation project yet, but I think we can do it. The state has been moving this direction for years. We've done big strategic studies. We've looked at different augmentation options. We've talked about different funding options. And what WIFA is, we're the next current step in that.
So what kind of water commitment would you like to see, not just your agency, but maybe in an even broader sense, from legislators, from the governor going forward, if it's not this year but next? I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is we've got to get serious about this at some point if we want to make it happen.
Yeah. So we go out, we talk to industry a lot, and we talk to potential customers a lot. We've gone and talked to potential investors. We've gone and talked to potential project developers. The public can see that. We did a request for information. We went out and talked to industry, and we have all the responses published on our website. And what they're asking us is, you, Chuck, you, WIFA board, you sound serious, but what you have in the bank right now isn't enough to finish it. So mm-hmm. how confident are we that you can do that? And so that's what we're asking for, right? We're asking for legislative leadership and the governor's office to help, to say something publicly, to say something that we can point to, that when we're sitting in these meetings, we say, yeah, you're not just talking to WIFA, but the state is behind this, not just one agency. Mm-hmm. There's also we had kicked around some ideas with legislators about additional powers, additional tools that could go into WIFA's toolbox to allow us to bring those projects to fruition. So I think those are the kind of things we're looking at. We realize this budget was a bunch of hard choices.
Yeah.
The state revenue is just really not in a good position right now. And so every agency was going to feel pain. We understand that. What we're asking to is, in that reality that there's not enough money to go around, let's look for those tangible ways to express support so the world knows that we're all in this.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Mm-hmm. Chuck Podolak, Director of WIFA, the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority of Arizona, joining us. Chuck, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Good Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A new partnership between a Phoenix-based puppeteer, HP, and a nonprofit aims to help neurodivergent kids learn to express themselves and their feelings. Stacy Corden is the founder of Puppet Pie and plays the first Sesame Street character with autism named Julia. The Print Pals program allows people to print out different puppet designs along with features that make those puppets completely customizable. Gordon says the project is specifically targeted for people who are neurodivergent, a group of people she says that includes her. Gordon brought some of her paper puppets to our studios recently to chat about it with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked why this is a particularly good activity for this population.
So they say that 73% of kids who are neurodivergent and adults have challenges expressing their feelings and their emotions. And while it's sometimes hard for even neurotypical people to express their feelings and emotions, it can be a little bit harder when you struggle to identify those. Doing art in general is a wonderful, wonderful way to express yourself. And then neurodivergent kids, specifically autistic kids, tend to connect with puppets way better than they do with human beings. Hmm. There are a lot of muscles in your face to have to parse out what they mean, whereas a puppet is very simple. It always says what it means. Its feelings are very obvious. Its whole body will express rather than just an eyebrow, and you have to figure out what does that eyebrow mean.
Yeah.
And so what we're doing is we're not only creating pieces that kids can put together to create whatever they want, whether it's a robot or a bird or a cow or a pig or a person, they can have that creature, that thing, express themselves however they see fit.
So was it a conscious decision then to try to keep the design relatively simple then to make it easier for neurodivergent kids to maybe understand, you know, if they're with a grown-up, for example, and they're, you know, using the puppet to make it easier for the child to understand what feelings the puppet is maybe trying to express?
Yeah. So what I did was I made a lot of different eyeballs and you've got some in front
of
you.
Yeah, I have. They're kind of like – they almost look like lima beans.
They almost look shape, like – yeah, yeah.
With, you know, the pupil, the black circle sort of toward the top.
Yeah, and they're tilted outwards a little bit. It looks a little bit maybe sad or worried.
Yeah.
Now I want you to turn those eyeballs upside down.
Okay.
And I very specifically didn't label any of the eyes with feelings because you can turn them upside down and now they look angry.
Yeah.
We
That's interesting.
We need to let kids express themselves without labels necessarily or have their puppet express. And then we can start a conversation, even if it's just planting a seed, even if they don't know, planting the seed of, I wonder how your puppet feels right now. Or, oh, I see that your puppet's eyes are turned inward. Is your puppet angry?
Mm.
Your puppet's mouth is open and it's got a big smile. Is your puppet happy? I wonder what made your puppet happy. I wonder what makes you happy. Just starting these conversations to get a little bit more, you know, social emotional well-being and frankly, the language of feelings out there so that we can help identify and express them.
Well, it sounds like it would maybe also be helpful for the parents of these kids to be able to connect with their kids and maybe help each other understand themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always say what's good for the goose is good for the gander. This is good for everybody.
So tell me about how you decided, like, which animals, like the designs of the people. So we have a cow here. And I know you have a pig and looks like you have a – is that a dinosaur?
This
you have
is
over
just
there?
A monster.
Just a monster.
Yeah, wearing roller skates.
Of course.
Yeah.
As one does.
As one does.
Like was it the thinking just to try to make them animals or designs that kids would recognize and sort of be drawn to?
Honestly, I wanted to give kids options. So these ears on this pig might be good on a unicorn.
Mm.
There are ears with hearing aids, human ears with hearing aids. There's a cochlear implant. There's an assisted communication device. There's pearl necklaces. There's robot parts. There's wheelchair wheels. There's, you know, monster feet. There's horse hooves. You could make a giraffe if you wanted to. You know, you don't have to color, you know, just because I colored this pink, you know, and it made it into a little pig. It could have been colored anyway.
So I want to ask you about the process of designing these, because paper is not your typical medium, right? Like, you're usually using felt and other, you know, more, I don't know, can we call them traditional puppet making materials?
Yeah. I would say like more malleable.
Yeah. So like, what was it like trying to make these that you knew that people would print out and cut out on their own and have to staple and tape and basically assemble themselves?
Yeah. Well, we wanted to do two different designs because one of the designs is more challenging. I would say that, you know, like fifth grade and up probably is a good target age group. But I also know that like some kids, especially neurodivergent kids, can really get into something mm-hmm. and want to spend a lot of time. And so we made this moving mouth puppet that has a curve to the head. Which is made out of flat paper. And paper doesn't exactly bend very well. but we also wanted to make something that was a little bit easier for younger kids to do. Mm-hmm. So if you can use scissors and cut on a curve, you can still do this project. So that's where the glove puppet came in. And that one doesn't have a moving mouth. The reason I love this one so much, you can hear the little.
Yeah. You're basically sticking your fingers. There's a like a slot behind the head of this dog you have where you can sort of control the, you know, attach it to your hand.
Yeah. It's a circular head with a little neck, and my fingers go up inside of the neck behind the paper body. And then my fingers can move the little arms from behind. What I love about this one so much is that it's so customizable with the mouths. Mm-hmm. You can turn them upside down. You can turn them to the side. I think the little girl over by you has a cute little smirk.
Yeah, she definitely has a little smirk here.
Yeah. And it was something that I really wanted, something that I wanted to show is that you can use the same pieces upside down, sideways, whatever, to get so many different expressions from one little puppet.
So when you talk about, you know, creating puppets, especially for neurodivergent kids, we need to talk about your sort of your day job, right? Which is on Sesame Street, where you play Julia, who is an autistic character.
Yeah.
I wonder like what you have learned from playing her and getting the feedback you get. I'm imagining you hear from a lot of families around the country who watch her on the show. And I'm curious how that has all sort of factored into what you're doing.
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. From playing her, I think that I've pulled, honestly, from seeing the public's response to her, I see just how important it is. And then I use my own personal experiences being neurodivergent, having sensory sensitivities. All of that goes into creating them. I think that with Julia, she's really helped me step into a place of advocacy more. When I was just the parent to an autistic child, I was his advocate, you know. But when you play a character on a television show, on a global television show, you're her advocate as well. And making sure that everything is right for her, kids like her, the inclusivity is really what I've tried to focus on.
All right. Stacey Gordon, thank you so much for coming in. It was lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great speaking with you again.
And now for the next installment in our Soapbox series. The theme is summer camp, a place where lots of kids experience their first romance. But for Tempe writer Deborah Sussman, it got complicated.
They say the more we revisit a memory, the less reliable that memory becomes. That seems to me a kind of cruel trick. The more important a memory is to us, the less likely we are to recall its details. But we keep trying. Colleen au Nuage was the second sleepaway summer camp I attended as a kid, and the first I actually liked. Colleen au Nuage means Cloud Hill in French. The camp's tagline was French with fun, which must have appealed to my parents, who wanted my brothers and me to speak many languages. At 11, I spoke only English and enough German to say, "My name is Deborah. I am a little girl." It was at this camp, nestled somewhere in the wilds of Quebec, on the shores of a placid lake, that I met a boy. How does young romance happen? I'm not sure. I only know that there was a boy, and he liked me, and I liked him. And one day we walked into the woods together and sat under a tree and dared to hold hands. As we sat there, we talked. Did we talk about where our parents lived? Did we talk about our favorite books? Now, all these years later, I only know that somewhere in what felt like the middle of our conversation, I told him that I was Jewish. There was a recalibration so immediate on his part that I felt it, as if he had mistaken me for someone else and now saw clearly. "You're Jewish," he said. "I hate Jews." And that was the end of the conversation and of our friendship. It didn't feel like it hurt me at the time. I'm not sure I even told anybody about it until college, when another student asked me if I'd ever experienced anti-Semitism. The boy's reaction stunned me more than anything else. How could that one piece of information about my identity change everything? I didn't consider that what he said might have affected me until I was a parent and similar things happened to my own child. I've been thinking a lot lately about our capacity as human beings to dislike someone based on the circumstances of their birth, something over which they have no control. What if that boy and I had kept talking? Is there a chance he might have changed his mind? Would I remember anything else about him beyond the fact that he said he hated me because I was Jewish? The world is so full of difficult and important conversations. I have to hope that we can overcome our preconceived beliefs and keep talking.
Je rêve des, je rêve des, je rêve d'évasion lente, mouillé mais sans dans l'océan.
That was Deborah Sussman. You can hear her essay again and check out other Soapbox essay collections at theshow.kjzz.org.
Toute notion du bien, du mal de l'horizon.
That'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Remontez-les dans 2000 ans.